Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Welcome back to the Stronger by Science podcast. My name is Eric Trexler. I am your special, temporary, primary host of the show. Today, I'm joined by Greg Knuckles. He is currently the permanent guest co-host for the time being. We have a lot of great stuff to cover in the episode today, but before we get into that, you might find yourself in a position where you feel like you enjoy the podcast and you feel like you want to act upon that enjoyment by supporting us. And there are many ways you could do that. You could like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get podcasts. You could join our email newsletter by going to strongerbyscience.com/newsletter. You could check out our coaches at Stronger by Science. We have a really excellent, experienced team of coaches who do one-on-one virtual coaching for training and for sports nutrition. You could use our discount code at bulksupplements.com. The code is SBSPOD. Gets you a 5% discount off of your entire order. You could subscribe to the Mass Research Review, which is a monthly research review where we cover the newest science in training and nutrition. And of course, you could check out Macro Factor. That is the diet app that we put together with a talented team of developers. And it does have a free trial, so you can take it for a spin and see if you like it. Greg, how is the road to the stage going?
Road to the stage is going pretty well. I hit a new low of 226.6 this past week. So I am officially down 40 pounds since I started using Macro Factor. And I am in total two-thirds of the way to my goal from my previous high weight of 278 point something. Trying to get down to sub 200. So I'm two-thirds of the way there. Which is, that's a nice little milepost. So looking forward, I'm in kind of a weird spot because, like, objectively speaking, like, diet fatigue is low. Like, I feel good. It's not hard to hit my targets. But I also just, for reasons I can't fully discern, am feeling waning motivation. Don't know why that is. So I don't know what the next few weeks will look like. May take a little break, may keep going. But for now, it's nice to hit that little milestone.
You know, a good way to kind of give yourself a little jolt of motivation?
Ask myself, how would I approach this situation if everyone who I loved would die if I didn't meet my goal?
That is a good way to do it. And a pretty realistic way to frame it too. But I was thinking I would just pick a show date, you know, just circle it on the calendar, find the show, order some trunks. Let's make this thing happen. All right. Road to Athens here. No major updates. I've been super, super busy doing a lot of writing lately. And so I've been using the gym as kind of a little break to kind of clear my head and move around a little bit, use up some energy. It's basically like I work out when I have writer's block. I'm like, all right, screw this. I got to move and get some blood flowing. Maybe I'll have some ideas floating around in my bloodstream. And if I increase cardiac output, they'll float to my brain. That's kind of my thinking there. But the other day, like, I've been doing a lot of basketball. I mentioned previously, for whatever reason, when I play basketball, the running posture, like the mechanics of running while playing basketball do not exacerbate any of my hip issues the way that kind of standard endurance running does. And posturally, it's quite different. You know, when you're dribbling a basketball, it looks very different from when you're just like coasting through like a 11 mile run, you know? Yeah. So basketball has been a great outlet for me to get some cardio in when I don't feel like swimming. And man, the other day I was just just kind of beating the hell out of myself to just burn off some energy. So I would just go full court. There's no one around. So I was just going layups back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, full court, trying to really keep the pace up. And man, I kind of forgot how hard basketball is when you're playing within that context of like full court, up and back, minimal rest.
Yeah.
And like, it really makes you, like right now the NBA playoffs are on. You develop a completely different appreciation for watching the game when you remember what it feels like to try to do a skilled action or activity when you're fatigued as hell. So like I would, you know, go do back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, and then pull up for a jumper. The task of trying to focus on executing a skilled action like that when you are absolutely gassed, it just gives you a completely different perspective. I think for some people who don't have a lot of experience playing basketball, you watch the NBA and you say, yeah, like if I were 6'11 and my job were to shoot all day, you know, in practice, like if I was shooting around, you know, 14 hours a week or whatever, I'm sure I'd be pretty good at basketball. You know, I think it's because NBA players are such outliers physically in most cases. I think sometimes there's a tendency to kind of not fully appreciate the challenges and demands of basketball.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
man, just go run some full court back and forth 6, 8, 10 times and then try to hit jumpers. Yeah, it restores your appreciation for the absolute unicorns that play NBA basketball.
So here's a here's a recommendation to you or anyone else listening to this right now. This is how I got really good at free throws, because I'm very good at free throws. So in middle school, we would do this drill at the end of practice where everyone on the team would just line up around the free throw line, and like, you know, everyone would shoot two. And basically, like, you know, middle schoolers aren't particularly good shooters. And if you can hit like 70% of your free throws in seventh grade, like that's pretty good. And so basically the coach would just have like that number where, you know, if we were shooting, it was more than this, but just to make the math easy, if we were shooting collectively 20 free throws, then if we made at least 14, we didn't have to run. But for every free throw under 14 that was made, we had to run a suicide, like free throw line back, half court back, other free throw line back, full court back. And so like during the off season, I was like, hey, you know, that seems like a good drill, like improve my free throw shooting, get in better shape. And so I would do that with myself, where I would just shoot free throws. And instead of running a full suicide, like I would shoot 10. And for every free throw I missed, I would run it down and back and just repeat the process. And it works really well, both for getting just better at free throw shooting, because you're shooting a ton of free throws, for shooting free throws well under fatigue, because you are running a fair number of down and backs, and then also just for conditioning, because like what you were mentioning, like it's far harder to shoot when you're fatigued. Like once I got quite good at shooting free throws, basically the way it would go is for the first 5 rounds, you know, I'm making 10 of 10, I'm making 9 of 10, things are going well. But once I maybe had 10 or 12 down and backs on my legs, then it would drop to like maybe 9 of 10, 8 of 10. And then once I started making like 7 of 10 or fewer, then the wheels would just fall off. And I'm just running enough that like just percentages drop horrifically. And like if I can make 40, 50%, I'm feeling pretty good. So if you do that for like an hour, it's an hour, like, but certainly by the end, you will have done a ton of conditioning and it just gets harder and harder over time. But yeah, that's how I got good at shooting free throws.
Yeah. I mean, that'll do it for sure.
And it's way more engaging than just like running on a treadmill for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. So feats of strength, what do you got for us this week?
Yeah, so I've got, I think we both have non-traditional feats of strength. So mine is for a strength sport that I don't know if we've ever talked about it on the podcast, but I think it's very cool, and that is arm wrestling. And so John Brzezink is possibly, I can't even say possibly, John Brzezink is the greatest arm wrestler of all time. Like, that's, I don't think you would find hardly any dissenters amongst that. He, I think, won his first world championship in 1982 at the age of 18 and was basically like the top heavyweight arm wrestler until like around 2010, give or take. Like, he basically had a 30-year span of dominance in the sport. And when I say heavyweight, like, he mostly competed at body weights between like 200 and like 225, sometimes up to 240. But he was kind of like Ed Cohn there for a while, where Cohn competing as a 220 would oftentimes beat the super heavyweights as well. John Brzezink at a body weight at around 200, 220, would sometimes just compete against the super heavyweight arm wrestlers who were huge and would beat most of them like during that 30-year reign of terror. And, but yeah, so just a tremendous career, great longevity. And he was at the top, or basically at the top, that entire time. But then he starts getting into his mid to late 40s. His results start dropping off a little bit. And, like, you know, he's getting older. Like, of course they're going to. And by the time he turned 50, like, his performance had dropped enough, and he was starting to accumulate some injuries, that he was like, you know what? It's been a good career. It's time to hang it up. So he did. He retired, I think, at 50 or 51 after a career that no one would be able to find flaws in. Like, just no, there was nothing left to prove. There was no reason he would need to ever compete again. And I'm sure you see where this is going. He made a return to competitive arm wrestling earlier this year after 7 years in retirement, at the ripe young age of 57 years old. And he is once again, and I don't follow arm wrestling close enough to have like a super strong take about this, but you could make the argument that he is once again the best heavyweight in the world. And if you would not sign off on that, he's certainly in the conversation. So he's not at a point anymore where he can beat the top super heavyweights. But against guys who are like 225, yeah, he looks like easily one of the top five guys in the world again, which is absolutely bizarre. Because, like, even when you think about athletes with great longevity, you know, you think about people who are still able to compete at a high level in their late 30s, maybe into their early 40s. You don't think about people who retire in their 50s, stay retired for 7 years, and then come back and aren't just competitive, but are once again among the best in the world. So it is truly remarkable what he has already accomplished. And it is, I would say, maybe even more remarkable what he is accomplishing in this moment and moving forward. Just a tremendous athlete who deserves more respect. I mean, he has all the respect in the world within the arm wrestling community, but, you know, that's not a sport that people follow. Like, it's not a sport that a ton of people follow. And even myself, as someone who's only like roughly follows it a little bit, I didn't find out he was back until he'd been competing for a couple months again already. But yeah, so if you don't follow arm wrestling, John Brzezink is still someone you should be aware of, just because, like, if you want to talk about people just across any competitive sport ever who have had the greatest careers, he would have to be in that conversation. Like, his dominance of the sport for so long, incredible, and the fact that he's able to come back and keep doing that at 57 just boggles the imagination.
Yeah, I can only think of one kind of analogous situation where somebody is at the top of a sport, retires at a, you know, kind of an older age relative to the sport, and then comes back and is quite competitive. And I'm thinking of George Foreman in boxing. Like, he's one of the only analogous situations I can think of. But we have an opportunity to see this once again, because as we know, Tom Brady had a lengthy retirement from professional football. but he has returned.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what he looks like after about 13 days of retirement. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah, you could also throw Satchel Paige in there.
Mm,
like right? I don't think he came back and like pitched full seasons, but he would occasionally come in for like an exhibition game, I think into his 60s, and still pitched at a high level.
Yeah, he would have been just fine in this era, because like starters only throw like 50 pitches and they're like, all right, get him out of there.
Oh yeah, he would have been a usable bullpen arm until like 75.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast the other day that was lamenting like, you just, with the way that pitching has evolved, you just do not see a lot of complete games anymore. You know, a starter back in the day, like I remember as a kid, you'd go to the ballpark and you'd see like Greg Maddux is on the hill, right? So yeah. You're like, oh man, that'd be incredible, you know, if we see him doing you know, if he goes like 8-9 innings, like you would expect that, you know, in the seventh inning he's gonna be on the hill.
Well, and it would be good because it would be a short game.
Yeah.
Greg Maddux was famous for pitching a complete game that would go like 2.5 hours.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just totally different now.
Dude, earlier this year, Clayton Kershaw had a perfect game going, I think, through 7, and they pulled him.
Yeah.
Which, like,
he did, yeah.
Maybe theoretically, that's like the right call for, you know, preserving an older arm. Like, you don't want to accumulate too much fatigue early in the season. But brother, if you got a perfect game going through 7, like, you got, the purist in me says, you got to at least let him try.
Yeah. I shouldn't go out on this limb because I'm not certain if it's true, but you know, the justification for pulling him was like, hey, it's a long season, we want to keep him off the injured list, keep him in the rotation. I believe he ended up getting pulled from the rotation recently anyway. To try to manage his load. So yeah. Like the idea was like, hey, we don't want to be in a position where we have to take him out of the rotation. And I think they did anyway, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, so then after that, people looked back in hindsight, and the people who were already annoyed that he got pulled, they're like, well, he ended up on the injured list anyway. So like, you know, good load management. but that might not be true, so I should probably stop discussing it at this point. I think I heard that, but I don't follow baseball very much. But you know what I do follow? I've got another feat of strength here that, you know, you mentioned it's really exciting to see kind of singular instances of feats of strength, but longevity is important as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, putting together a career of impressive feats. Big Don Gorski. Big Don is a nickname I gave him, but Don Gorski, he just reached a milestone. He has been eating Big Macs approximately every single day for now 50 years. I believe that in the last 50 years, he has only missed a handful of days. And it's been things like, I believe it was like the day his mother died, a day where he lives up north, I think in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so like a McDonald's just didn't open because like it was snowed in and like no one could get to work.
Yeah.
And I even read that nowadays he buys extra Big Macs and has them in the freezer just to make sure something like that never happens again. So over the last 50 years, he has totaled over 32,000 Big Macs, which is, it blows the previous record out of the water by a mile. He documents everything. He keeps receipts. He even keeps boxes, the little cardboard box that the Big Mac comes in. So like this guy has the receipts. He's got the proof. And I think it's safe to say it's a record that no one will ever touch. But he was also ahead of the curve when it comes to the, like, if it fits your macros, like, oh, I'm going to eat, you know, Twinkies every day and prove to everyone that it's okay. You know, by every indication, it looks like he's still in pretty good health. Every now and then he'll go, like, get his cholesterol checked. It's always within normal ranges. So he's been working on that if it fits your macros anecdotal experiment for 50 years now and doing pretty good. Not a recommendation. I wouldn't necessarily say you should eat one or two Big Macs a day, but anyway, congrats to Big Don on passing 50 years.
Dude, this guy was in Super Size Me, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's made a bit of a cultural impact. He's been on quite a few things.
Yeah, I just searched him and I remember seeing him from Super Size Me, and he just seemed like a very affable, like, hippie type guy with the, like, round John Lennon style glasses, but with transition lenses. Just absolute king shit. That's awesome.
Yeah, man, it's incredible. All right, so moving on. We've got some segments prepared for today, getting into some science. I know our last episode was very anecdote heavy. The pendulum is swinging back. We're talking science today. So I wanted to have a very brief research review about sedentary time, just because I've been digging into some of this literature, and this kind of builds upon some of your previous segments about walking, you know, because a lot of times we think about sedentary time and we think about, okay, it seems to have an independent deleterious impact on health and wellness. How might we rectify that? And one kind of proxy measurement you can use is daily step count, which you've kind of addressed. Generally speaking, if you have a pretty high step count, it's unlikely that you have a tremendous amount of total cumulative sedentary time because you're out there walking a lot. It also...
It at least places an upward constraint on how much sedentary time you can have.
Yeah, it's a proxy. It's not a perfect indicator, but generally speaking, if you have a high step count, that is likely to at least correlate with having relatively lower total sedentary time and theoretically relatively fewer very prolonged stretches of continuous sedentary time. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if you have a pretty high step count, it means you're getting up, you're moving, you're walking, and generally speaking, having less total sedentary time and hopefully less continuous sedentary time as well. So just to kind of build upon that, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the independent ramifications of sedentary time and a couple other strategies that you could use outside of just monitoring step count. Because I know for some people, monitoring step count, you know, there are some people that really like to have a very quantitative approach to their health and wellness. They like to track everything. They like everything to be numerical. And they can, you know, do different types of interventions to influence those numbers. But I wanted to talk about a couple other potential strategies. So first of all, it's important to establish that, you know, you established very effectively in previous episodes that low step count seems to be associated with some deleterious outcomes related to health. There are other meta-analyses that have looked not just at step count as a proxy, but specifically looking at different forms of sedentary activity and how those relate to health and wellness. So, for example, there was a meta-analysis by Patterson and colleagues, and I'm going to link all three of these in the show notes. But Patterson and colleagues found that total sitting time and television viewing time were associated with higher risks of several different chronic disease outcomes. And that was despite controlling for physical activity. So we're talking about the independent impact of sedentary time that you can't necessarily offset by saying, hey, I go for a jog 3 days a week. Like there is, it's difficult to defend the case that regular participation in structured exercise completely nullifies the deleterious independent impact of being sedentary for large portions of the day, especially for extended discrete periods of time. So Patterson and colleagues found this despite controlling for physical activity. Biswas and colleagues found significant associations between sedentary time and risk of a variety of negative health outcomes related to mortality and chronic disease incidence. And this negative impact from excessive sedentary time, it was certainly more pronounced among people who had low physical activity levels, but the association still persisted after controlling for physical activity in the entire sample. And then finally, Eklund and colleagues found that sedentary time was significantly associated with mortality risk in individuals with low activity levels, low physical activity levels. And it was interesting because they did some stratification by physical activity level. And, you know, like I said, the association with negative health outcomes or mortality risk, I should say, was significant in the lowest third of physical activity levels. But if you look at the high activity, moderate activity, low activity kind of subgroups, within each of them, you could see the same pattern where regardless of where you fall, like having high activity level certainly attenuated, you know, especially like for this is relevant to people who do structured exercise. it seems to attenuate the magnitude of the deleterious outcome from sedentary time, but the general relationship still persists. What I mean by that is when you look at the low, medium, or high activity groups, within those groups, you can see that relationship where the higher your sedentary time gets, the more likely that you're going to see an elevated risk of all-cause mortality. So this is collectively, the literature indicates that, you know, certainly it's good to do structured exercise and to have, you know, a really intentional focus on getting out and doing discrete bouts of physical activity, but there's still an independent negative impact of really excessive sedentary time. And we see these kinds of things in studies with athletes, right? Even competitive athletes, you can look at some research where within a cohort of competitive, highly, you know, really well-trained athletes, there are still associations between sedentary time and outcomes related to body composition, for instance. I know Dr. Helms, the other Eric, reviewed a paper in Mass a year or two ago looking at the fact that among really well-trained athletes, higher sedentary time was associated with lower relative fat-free mass and higher relative fat mass. Mm-hmm. So this stuff persists even among people who have a really high level of engagement in structured exercise. So what do we do about that? I think that there are two goals that you want to have in terms of offsetting some of these potentially deleterious impacts of sedentary time. The first would be just reducing the total cumulative sedentary time you have throughout the week. The second goal, I think, is beyond that effect. If you can break up long, extended periods of uninterrupted sedentary time, there is some research to indicate that that might be particularly beneficial. So, you know, I know there are intervention studies where they will look at some of the acute cardiometabolic impacts of an exercise bout, and they'll find that those acute benefits of structured exercise can be really dramatically attenuated by just doing like 4 days of increased sedentary time. You know, so we want to make sure that, you know, and the way that they do that is with long, uninterrupted blocks of sedentary time. So I think a strategy for reducing total cumulative sedentary time throughout the week is very simple. It's just planning out activities that might not be structured exercise, but they are non-sedentary activities. So we can generally define sedentary behaviors as behaviors that are performed in a seated, reclined, or lying position with a MET value less than or equal to 1.5. And MET is an acronym that is short. It's not really an acronym, but they always capitalize it. but it's short for metabolic equivalent. Yeah. And we had an interesting conversation off air about how metabolic equivalents were determined. It's not the most robust science. It's basically like back in the day when research was very hard to do, they measured one dude who was 40 years old and about 70 kilograms. And they're like, how much oxygen does this guy consume if we just sit him down in a chair and measure it? Turns out 3.5 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram of body mass per minute.
Yeah,
I think that's how it goes. And so, yeah, from there, the MET was born. The MET is a standardized amount of oxygen consumption per kilogram of body mass per minute. And so you can debate, you know, how well that transfers to different populations.
You can and you should.
Yeah. I say you can debate. There are many papers explaining exactly why that number doesn't transfer to a variety of populations. But it kind of doesn't matter that much. If you're just using it as a broad metric for identifying different general activity levels, it still has utility within that context. I would not use it for individualized calculations of energy cost of a specific exercise bout. There are better ways to do that, which I might get into at a later date. But if you're just trying to say, hey, I need to break up my sedentary time, the way that you would do that is look at a list of different types of exercise or just general physical activities and say, hey, I want to find stuff that's at least higher than 1.5 METs. And if you get over, if you get into the range of like 2 to 2.9 METs, that would generally be considered light or low intensity physical activity. So that kind of sets a general range for where you would be finding some degree of activity that is beyond rest, but not necessarily structured exercise. And you might be saying, well, Eric, there's so many potential activities that one could do. Where would I find such a list? And there's actually a tremendous list that is publicly available. There's a 2011 Compendium of Physical Activities by Ainsworth and colleagues, and it's openly accessible. You can download it, and I think it has 821 different physical activities at different intensities as well. So you can go into that and find a lot of stuff. I mean, mowing the lawn, sweeping your house, mopping the floor, all sorts of stuff, standing, sitting, walking at a variety of different speeds, shoveling snow. I mean, there are just so many different types of exercise or types of physical activity listed here, and they're categorized into groups. So there's like bicycling, conditioning exercises, dancing, fishing and hunting, home activities, home repair, inactivity or quiet kind of resting behaviors, lawn and garden, miscellaneous, playing music, occupational tasks, running, self-care, bathing, taking medication, hairstyling, like so many different things in here, even religious activities. If you joined me on the road to enlightenment, I'm sorry to say that meditation, only a MET value of one.
Ooh, that's rough.
Yeah, so a shortcut to enlightenment, but not a shortcut to shredded. But there are some physical or some religious activities. They got what do they have here? There was one that was like 4.5. They put moderate to heavy effort of manual labor under religious activities. I'm not sure how that would all kind of work in there, but maybe there's a way.
If you're like building houses with like a religious charity organization or something.
They do have volunteer activities as well in here.
Whoa, that's quite the category. How do they assign a MET value to that?
They have a bunch of different, standing light, moderate work, standing moderate lifting.
I thought you were saying that just like an exercise they had was just volunteer activity.
Anything you're doing that is not compensated is this number of METs.
Yeah, I thought that's what you were saying.
No,
like,
it's a whole category.
That's wild.
It's a whole category where they talk about like, playing with like chasing after kids that you're, volunteering with like a youth group or something. Yeah. The one I was looking for, praise with dance or run is a religious activity with 5 METs.
Whoa.
That's the high MET value I was searching for there. So basically the short version of this is for just an enormous range of outcomes. You can find MET values and kind of engage in those activities to schedule into your week certain different discrete things you want to do to break up your sedentary time and to have some non-sedentary activities. So this isn't the type of thing that you would do every hour on the hour, but you could say, you know what, on Saturday, I think I'm going to go mow the lawn. It has to be done anyway, and I can, get some activity there. Sunday, I'll do some house chores. You can find in here dishwashing, mopping, sweeping. But you can start to move some of these things throughout your week so that you break up sedentary time and maybe have one physical activity per day or two physical activities per day that are, non-sedentary, but also not structured exercise. But I should mention, this list also has a lot of utility if you're looking to plan out different forms of structured cardio as well. So for bicycling, for example, they have all different intensity levels. For walking, they have all different intensity levels for different speeds of walking, different grades of walking, walking forwards versus backwards. Like, this is a truly comprehensive and really impressive list of activities. So even if you don't care about this podcast segment, but you exercise and you want to have a general idea of comparing intensity levels, that is linked in the show notes, and it's really, really useful. Another potential strategy, which is, I think, especially helpful for breaking up long periods of sedentary activity, is using something called exercise snacks. And this is something that's picking up some momentum in the peer-reviewed literature, But it's basically these really short, isolated bouts of vigorous exercise that are performed for very short periods of time, but done periodically throughout the day. So, for example, you might do 3 20-second intervals of vigorous stair climbing. Like, it, literally what this looks like is you're at your desk job in the office, step away from the desk, instead of walking to the water cooler, you go to the stairwell, 20 seconds hard, catch your breath, 20 seconds hard, catch your breath, 20 seconds hard, catch your breath, boom, you're done for the hour. And so, like, you'll find different approaches to this concept of exercise snacks. But generally speaking, it's, you know, you might do something really short every hour on the hour. But of course, you can adapt that, do it every other hour. There are also some that are a little bit longer that are kind of closer to like 5 minutes, but you would do them maybe every 3 to 4 hours. But the general idea is scheduling in planned regular breaks. You know, the previous list of activities was more oriented toward, I'm going to do something that has a different purpose, but I'm getting physical activity as I'm doing it, right? Yeah. I'm mowing the lawn because my grass is long, but it's nice to know that I'm breaking up my sedentary time. But for this, it is exercise for the purpose of exercise, and it's done on a more regular schedule and done several times throughout the day. And so what they try to do with this approach is do interventions with a lot of ecological validity and a lot of practical utility. So they try to do things like stair walking, brisk walking, air squats, sit to stand, like basically chair squats, body weight calisthenics. The idea is that you could, in a wide range of occupations, take a second, go do this for 3-4 minutes, get back to your chair and not be disruptive and not have to like drive to the gym, change clothes, take a shower, etc. Mm-hmm. So this is an area of research that is just getting rolling, but these are some nice strategies. If you're someone who was really interested by Greg's previous segments about walking, but you don't necessarily do that well psychologically with highly quantitative approaches to exercise, if you'd prefer to,
or if you just don't have time to get in that many steps.
True.
It's like that. Yeah. It is time consuming.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah. You know, the time consuming component is big, but I've also seen instances in the physique athlete world where people will tend to take things to extremes. You know, psychologically it is an extreme endeavor, and sometimes people respond really unfavorably when you say, hey, try to walk 15,000 steps per day. And it's like they are so fixated on that number all day. It's really detrimental to quality of life for some people. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways to break up your sedentary activity, and there's ample evidence to suggest that it can be a really positive thing to do so.
So I've actually got an anecdote related to exercise snacks.
Cool.
So back in the day, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before. I read a book many of you have probably heard of called The 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss. And do not count this as a recommendation to read that book. There's some good practical advice mixed with some not so good advice. Not the best signal to noise ratio you'll come across. But one of the things he recommended for, I think, completely incorrect reasons has actually turned out to be relatively helpful for me. So he had this whole section about just like, hey, how can you use the magic of nutrient repartitioning to ensure that you can eat a bunch of food and not gain any fat? And he was like, well, so look, you have these glucose transporters in muscles, and if you just do 40 bodyweight squats before a meal, that's going to cause a ton of non-insulin mediated GLUT4 translocation. All of those carbs you take in, they're just gonna go straight to your muscles. There's no way they could possibly meet any other metabolic fate. So boom, you've hacked your metabolism, and all it takes is 40 bodyweight squats.
Wow.
And so yeah, that's that's not true. But you know, when I first encountered that information, I was much dumber and more naive, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll give this a shot. And so I didn't notice physical effects that comported with what I was told to expect in the book. But, What I did find is just that doing some bodyweight squats from time to time did just help me feel mentally sharper and kind of feel better. So I've actually developed a bit of a habit where, like, not every time, but most of the time when I use the bathroom, I just do like 20 bodyweight squats before I leave.
While you're using...
Yeah, I mean, it's good for practicing your aim. There's a, you know, it makes a day-to-day activity kind of like a mini game that you might play in like a Mario Party or something. But no, afterwards. I find that, you know, it just helps get the blood flowing. I find that I have more, like, I feel more energetic and just have more mental clarity after that. And yeah, it's very simple. So that's something, at least anecdotally, that has been helpful for me.
Good stuff. Now, let's shift to some really important topics here. Some hard-hitting science about... Well, I'll just let you introduce it.
All right, so...
I've already made my juvenile joke for the day.
Yeah, so first, before I get into this segment, I just need to let you know that this is one for the boys. So... any women listening to this, you need to turn it off right now, or just look at the timestamp, skip ahead to the next segment. This is not for you, mostly because we, as the lads, don't want you learning our secrets to, you know, figure out how to get you in bed. So again, this is one for the fellas. Any women still listening, just skip ahead. So all right. All right, lads, now that I know you're the only ones still listening, this podcast is finally taking the turn all of you have been wanting this whole time. You're thinking, hey, evidence-based fitness information, that's fine. Evidence-based nutrition information, cool, I guess. But ultimately, I want evidence-based information on getting laid. So, you know, we're finally taking that turn. This is... science-based mating strategy advice. that is actually what I'm talking about. And I'm doing this because there is a new study that's been published that I've seen being shared by three distinct but also interlapping groups of people. And that is fitness professionals, masculinity influencers, and incels. Way more overlap than one would hope. And I will say these three groups of people are, by and large, taking somewhat different things away from this study. But I've seen enough fitness people share this, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. This is worth talking about. So the actual study, unsurprisingly, isn't being shared around that much, but a press release, I guess, or like an article about this study, I have seen getting shared around quite a bit. And the press release or article is from realclearscience.com. Sounds very good, very credible. And the title of the article is "The Male Trait That Best Predicts Men's Mating Success." So, you know, that's quite the headline. If you're a male and you want to be more successful mating, you know, that might entice you to click and maybe share it. And when you get into this article, I'll just read a bit of this. And, you know, you can just think to yourself, what is the vibe that I'm getting from this article about this paper? All right, so it starts. In a massive meta-analysis that was years in the making, psychologists from the University of Durham and the University of St. Andrews in the United Kingdom explored how six masculine traits, a deep voice, height, testosterone levels, facial masculinity, finger-digit ratio, and strength/muscularity, impacted men's mating and reproductive success. One trait was the clear winner. So, okay, we're one paragraph in. You know, it's saying massive meta-analysis, years in the making, like really hyping this up, and one trait is the clear winner. So that's leaving you with the implication that this is something you can really take to the bank, and also that one particular thing is having a far larger magnitude of an effect than anything else. All right, so Moving on, the analysis, which combined 96 studies looking at 177,000 subjects from around the world across a wide variety of cultures, was published in February to the journal eLife. And that's another thing worth noting. I did not see anyone talking about this study when it was published in February. Now that this article is published, seeing way more people talking about it. So once again, this is kind of science by article, not people really digging into the full text. Let's see, lead author, Dr. Linda Lidbor, whose academic focus is on the traits that influence human mating decisions, and her colleagues found that men who were more muscular and physically stronger reported having more sexual partners. They also fathered more children. Height, testosterone levels, and a deeper voice predicted mating success to a lesser degree, but none of these traits were linked to having more kids. Masculine facial features, like a square jaw and a prominent chin, were not associated with increased mating or reproductive success, nor was a masculine finger-digit ratio, in which the index finger is relatively shorter than the fourth digit or the ring finger. Researchers say the results support the theory that, as humans evolved, males competed with each other for females' attention, and that women usually chose, or were forced, that's quite the parenthetical, to mate with the winners. And then here's a quote from the authors, In species with male intersexual competition, males tend to evolve to become larger, stronger, and more formidable than females, as they are in humans. So yeah, that's the basic vibe. And then the last paragraph does note that some of the predictors were rather weak, and that, you know, they don't fully explain human reproductive choices, but
maybe only like 80-90%.
Yeah, they don't put numbers on anything. They basically just say, hey, here are these things, there are some associations, and of them, body masculinity is far and away the strongest predictor. So you read that, and you would have every reason to assume that, like, whatever. They didn't actually put any numbers in this study, but it at least has to be a pretty meaningful predictor for this article to exist as it does. And therefore, you know, people are sharing it around, fitnessy people saying, like, hey guys, like this is why you need to come train with me. Like it's really gonna help your mating success. Masculinity influencers saying incels saying what you would expect them to say, like, this is why you should take the black pill. Like it's over for us who don't have masculine facial features and are just not naturally big and strong. And then like masculinity influencers basically splitting the difference where it's just like, yeah, this is why you should get big and strong. And also why you're fucking done for if you don't, whatever. So, you know, all of that is well and good. This is the article being shared. Those are the takes I'm seeing from it. But man, it sure would be inconvenient if you could actually pull up the paper and look at the strength of some of these associations. And so that's exactly what I did. And when you pull up this paper, you can just scroll straight down to table 2. I will note free full text, so if you want to read this, you absolutely can. So yeah, just scroll down to table 2 and look at the strength of the associations between these various traits and mating success, which is basically just like how many sexual partners have you had / have you had sexual partners? And then there's a separate table for reproductive success, like basically have you had kids? And yeah, so for mating success... It is true that body masculinity, which was a composite measure of strength and muscularity, did have the strongest association with mating success.
Well, there you go.
And so just based on that little, well, not snippet, like basically the whole article that I just read you, just kind of think to yourself, like, based on how that article was worded, how strong of an association do you think there was between body masculinity and mating success? You know, probably at least a moderate correlation, maybe even a strong correlation. But no, dear listener, we're talking about an R value of 0.113. And so you may be asking, what does that mean? How do I interpret that? So you can square an R value and get what is very logically called an R squared value, or coefficient of determination, which basically tells you how much shared variance there is between two measurements. Sometimes that will be phrased as how much does variation in one trait or one measure explain variation in another measure. So the R squared value we're looking at here is 0.017. So basically like 1.7% of the variance in mating success is explained by body masculinity. I hope you're not thinking, how much is 1.8%? Because it's not much.
For context here, like if you were going to pretend that you had a model that perfectly predicted an outcome, you would intuitively need the R squared of the entire model together to be 100%. You'd have to predict 100% of the variance in the outcome. So yeah, if you are predicting less than 2% of the variance in the outcome, that reflects the strength of the relationship and the confidence level you have. If you say, oh wow, well, if I manipulate that variable, you know, what kind of an impact will that have on the outcome?
Yeah. So we were talking about this before we started recording. Sometimes in the medical literature, you'll see a metric called NNT, or number needed to treat. So basically, like if you're testing a new treatment compared to one that's already well established and the new treatment tends to work better, NNT is basically just like how many people on average would you need to give the new treatment to before on average one of them would have meaningfully better outcomes than were observed with the comparator treatment. It kind of helps like contextualize things. Like if one thing does seem to be better, you shouldn't necessarily expect it to have like way better outcomes for every patient being treated. Like there's still scale involved. Like you need to treat a fair number of people before the differences kind of become apparent. So we were kind of joking that like maybe we need a metric for research like this that's like NNF, like number needed to fuck. Like, you know, like if you have 100 people with high body masculinity and 100 people with low body masculinity, like how many more people have the folks with high body masculinity taken to bed? Like maybe one or two in total. Like that's kind of the magnitude we're talking about here for like what an R squared value of 1.7% means. All of which is to say, this is a tremendous example of something we talk about from time to time, where if you have enough data going into an analysis, it's very easy to find things that are statistically significant. But statistical significance and actual practical relevance are two very different things. Something that in a meta with 177,000 subjects is predictive of a particular outcome. If the strength of that association is as weak as what we're observing here, then like the actual practical relevance of that outcome in your life very well could be and probably would be effectively nothing. So that's one thing I wanted to touch on. Next thing I wanted to touch on is just that just the level of confirmation bias I've seen from people sharing this around. Like folks who have a vested interest in trying to convince you to get as big and strong as possible, you know, to buy their coaching, consume their content, whatever, are sharing this to say like, look, if you follow me on Instagram, you're gonna get laid way more. And the results don't support that. And then on the other side, like the incel type individuals that I've seen sharing this, it's just like, yeah, this confirms everything we've been saying. Like the black pill, fully scientifically validated. It's over for us. We have low facial masculinity, low body masculinity. This major meta-analysis confirms that no woman will ever want to sleep with us. So like it's over, boyos. And like, once again, no, it doesn't fucking say that. And so like, yeah, this is, you know, it's, it's a study that I think if you interpret it well, basically means that like these things, maybe there's some degree of predictive value in a large enough population, but like the practical relevance to any discrete individual is virtually none. But man, I still see people taking such big swings that like whatever their worldview is around the value of body masculinity, this study confirms it, which is very fun. And let's see. The other thing I wanted to touch on is, like I mentioned before, the concept of science by press release. So like I mentioned, I've not seen people sharing this actual study around. I think that's partially because like science is hard to read, a lot of numbers, whatever, a lot of words as well. It's a lot easier reading articles or press releases than it is original literature. But also like this article, it's like the scientific study itself wouldn't be particularly shareable by any of the people who I see sharing it. Because if you're sharing this study and your followers actually see the data, if they have taken a basic statistics class, they could look at it and be like, oh yeah, this none of this shit is predictive. Like, what is this person on about? But yeah, like there are a lot of the bad scientific interpretations that I see being shared around, oftentimes it's from a generally decent study, and then just the articles written about the study like kind of suck, or just like overhype it, and then the articles are what get shared, and so the perception of what the study says by the people who have only read the articles about the study doesn't actually match particularly well what the study actually says. And I think this is a very good example of that.
You're referring to literally everything that's ever been said about resveratrol.
Yes. Also that. Yeah, that's most of what I wanted to say about this study. I wouldn't be surprised if you're listening to this. I wouldn't be surprised if you see either the Real Clear Science article pop up on your timeline, or just some other article about this study pop up. And if you do, just remember R.133, R squared, 1.7, 1.8%. Like that's the takeaway from this study. So just be informed if you come across this bit of information. The one thing I will note, like a kind of technical science-y note, which to give the authors of the actual study credit, they mentioned this as well. For their meta, they assumed a linear relationship between these traits, like basically that, you know, higher body masculinity would be predictive of greater mating success with, you know, basically across the spectrum. Like if you go from very low to low, low to medium, medium to high, high to very high, that each increase in those increments would improve mating success.
Which tends to be a pretty default assumption.
Correct.
With a lot of research questions. If you don't have specific reason in theory to question the linearity, the most common default assumption is going to be a linear kind of relationship.
Yeah. So that was an assumption in this meta-analysis. But one of the things the authors noted, and this is a very appropriate technical note, is that if you did have a nonlinear relationship, there could actually be a strong relationship that is just a weak linear relationship. And so like a great example of that would be if you had a perfect parabolic relationship and you tried to fit a linear trend line to it, the R value would be zero because, you know, it's a well-defined relationship that is very poorly explained by a linear trend line.
Parabolic being like an upside down U basically.
Yeah. So, you know, that could be the case where, you know, it very well could be if they did a nonlinear analysis, they might find that like moderate body masculinity was maybe more associated with mating success, and then with similar drop-offs in mating success with very high body masculinity and very low body masculinity. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying that if they're using linear modeling, that is a possibility that can't be ruled out. But that also doesn't lend itself particularly well to the take on this study that I see fitness people going with, where it's just like, yeah, you need to get as strong and jacked as possible to maximize your odds of mating success. Like that. Yeah. So I don't know if there is a nonlinear relationship here. Just saying, like, if there were, you could still have like an actual relationship that just wouldn't be picked up by a linear trend line. Damn, that's a weak note to close on, but whatever. Well, yeah, that's all I have to say about this.
It is a weak note. I'm not gonna argue with that, but
that's why I'm the co-host.
Yeah, but it is kind of representative of the fact that like when you are presenting evidence in a nuanced manner, unfortunately, it doesn't lend itself to the big finish. You know, where you say like, oh, I'm gonna really hit the high note here and walk off.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's science is nuanced, and so like it's very atypical that you get the opportunity to write that big, big splashy headline that is fully representative of a study finding. Usually there's some more details and you say, here's what it tells us, here's what it doesn't necessarily tell us. Mm-hmm. And then you pick it up from there.
But yeah, so the biggest takeaway here is one for the fellas, like just do you. If you feel insecure, like, oh man, like one of the other things to note, like I already mentioned this, but I really focused most of this discussion on the body masculinity bit, because that was the part that they that the article really harped on. But yeah, like if you're a short king out there and you see this article being shared around and you're like, oh man, it also said that height was a predictor of mating success, where taller people have it better. That was another statistically significant relationship with an even lower R value. That was an R of 0.057. So, I mean, that would be an R squared value of like 0.5% or like 0.3%. So once again, like if you're a short king and you're like, oh no, like it's never going to work out for me. Height was not predictive of mating success for all intents and purposes. If you're like, oh no, I'm self-conscious about the fact that my ring finger is longer than my pointer, or my pointer finger is longer than my ring finger, and that means I have low T, and that means no woman will ever love me. One, if that's a thought that's gone through your head, you consume too much incel content. Stop it. Like anytime you see someone bring up digit ratios, never listen to them again. Yeah, or if you're like, oh no, I don't have a strong jawline. Also, don't fucking worry about it. Not predictive. Yeah, just like chill out, be you, be a cool person, treat people well, and stuff should work out.
Good advice. All right, so I've got a quick segment I want to do on high intensity interval training. I'm considering it a coach's corner because I'm not going to do a super thorough dive in the literature, but this is another instance of me kind of seeing things on social media that is kind of wrapped in this evidence-based label. And I saw, you know, someone make this claim, and then a lot of people who purport to be very evidence-based sharing this claim. And I kind of wanted to clear or kind of set the record straight here. So the claim I saw, somebody like kind of made a post.
Ooh, also, welcome back, ladies. We're glad for you to rejoin us.
Yeah.
After skipping that last segment.
Welcome back. Yeah. So the claim that I saw was all about high intensity interval training, which I will call HIIT. And the whole idea was like, listen, if you're doing HIIT, if you're doing true high intensity interval training, like you should not be able to do a work interval that's longer than like 30 seconds. Like if you can do this for 45 seconds or a minute, like bad news, you're not doing HIIT. And like, if you think that your, you know, group exercise class or your boot camp class is doing HIIT, like you're kidding yourself. And also you're a joke. So like the whole idea was like, you know, only very few of us are tough enough to actually do interval training. We all puke when we're done with it. And if you're not puking or dreading, you know, your workout, it's not actually high intensity interval training. And so I saw people sharing it and commenting saying, yeah, you tell them, good stuff. And the reason that it rubbed me the wrong way was like, this was largely kind of the vibe to me was to discourage people who are engaging in some of these other forms of higher intensity exercise that doesn't fit a very specific paradigm of interval training. You know, so like calling out like a group exercise class or a boot camp class, that's usually people who are like beginner or intermediate exercisers, not always, but often. And so they're trying to engage in other forms of exercise and enjoying it and feeling good about it until they open up their phone and they see everybody just shitting on them for entertainment. I don't like the way that it makes high intensity interval training seem inaccessible to a large portion of the population. That was my first concern. My second concern was it's not true. It's wrong. It's false. It's fake news. It's any combination or permutation of words that mean, hey, that's not a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
So like what really bothers me is saying I'm going to dunk on people in the name of evidence-based fitness. By the way, I've never engaged with this evidence. I've never opened up one paper about high intensity interval training. I have no idea what's going on in that research. So it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way because, man, would you believe that one of the most common high intensity interval training interventions that you will ever find in the literature involves a 4-minute work bout. So it's 4 minutes of exercise at a high intensity, followed by usually about 3 minutes of kind of the rest interval or the lower intensity interval. So
have you ever considered that maybe the people in research who defined what high intensity interval training means actually don't know what high intensity interval training is?
Well, correct. That is kind of the underlying premise of this type of post is like, I am going to set a definition for this that is fully contradictory to all of the scientific evidence that has determined what this intervention is and what it does.
Yeah.
But also it happens to be evidence-based.
Yeah.
So figure out how to make that work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it was just a really annoying post to me because it discouraged people from engaging in these forms of exercise that might be quite helpful to them. And again, it was using evidence-based fitness as a label to dunk on people while fully contradicting and misunderstanding the totality of evidence. So if you're interested in high-intensity interval training, like there have been so many protocols out there. I'm looking at a table from a review paper that I'm going to link in the show notes. But you could do, you know, 10 work intervals that are 1 minute long, 8 that are 2 minute long, 7 that are 3 minutes long, 4 that are 4 minutes long, 30-second work intervals. I mean, you will find a huge range of work interval durations and a huge variation in the kind of ratio between work interval and rest interval. But generally speaking, if you look at the literature, you can call something high intensity interval training usually if you're getting above 85% of your, you know, predicted maximal heart rate or measured maximal heart rate. And some will even define that threshold as low as 80. Like, I mean, we are not talking about completely exhaustive exercise bouts here. We are talking about getting your heart rate up to 80, 85% of max heart rate, sustaining it there for anywhere from 15 seconds to 4 minutes, based on the literature, and kind of repeatedly doing that. So
I sincerely think that the publication of the Tabata study is one of the most harmful things that has occurred in scientific history. That's an exaggeration. I'm being hyperbolic, and not because it's a bad study, but just like that I think has become the default mental model for people, like what appropriate intensity is for like high intensity interval stuff. And like the whole purpose of that paper was just like, what if we took people who are already really highly trained and put them through a way higher intensity protocol than has been used previously? I think that's like the mental model that people work with when it's like kind of defining training intensity for high intensity interval training. But like that paper is an outlier in terms of the types of intensity they used.
Yeah, and another common way to do it, people saw some of these modified Wingate approaches, which fits the definition of sprint interval training rather than high intensity interval training. You can consider sprint interval training to basically be something of a subset or kind of a subtype of high intensity interval training. And if you're doing sprint interval training, that is a maximal exhaustive bout in the vast majority of cases. And those do tend to be pretty short and have pretty pretty large ratios of rest interval to work interval. So, for example, this got big in the natural bodybuilding world. I'm going to sprint until I puke for like 30 seconds on a bike, and then I'm going to rest for like 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes and try to work up the courage to do another. And basically people would do a few of those sprints and say, this is how we define interval training, and anything else is fake. It's just not an evidence-based claim, and it very directly contradicts the vast majority of evidence that we have related to high intensity interval training. And I was going to do a longer segment where I talk a little bit about the pros and cons of interval training and how to incorporate it into a concurrent program for someone who's lifting and doing interval training. But it literally looks like the world is ending outside. This weather is disastrous, so I'm not sure how much longer we're going to have power. We're getting pretty close on time here, so I'm going to save the longer hit segment for next episode, because, I just don't have faith in any of our equipment continuing to work for more than a couple minutes here. This is actually really, it's a shame. I was looking at a map on like a meteorology website, mm-hmm. and Tornado Alley is just like shifting east. And so I used to find it very comforting that I moved far enough east from Ohio that I'm like, I'm not going to see a lot of tornadoes.
Yeah.
And it seems like we're getting more and more of those. And the meteorology patterns would suggest that Tornado Alley is just consistently creeping further and further east. We're not squarely in it yet, but there's some nasty stuff going on.
Yeah, there. Like I don't know how much of this is coming through the mics, because I think the pickup field is calibrated pretty well, but it's loud out there. The wind is deafening. It's currently 4:15 p.m. In the late spring in North Carolina. It should be very bright. It looks like the sun went down about 45 minutes ago. we might be facing the end of days. So who knows? This episode might, if someone uploads it, it might be our letter from beyond the grave.
I don't know if I mentioned this. Wish
us the best.
I'm not sure if I mentioned this on the podcast, but recently a tree like kind of fell on my house.
Yeah.
And so, man, every time the wind blows, I get like a little knot in my stomach. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind knowing what's going on back at the house right now.
And almost as catastrophically, the last time it got windy, it blew over several of Lindsay's potato plants. There are plenty of casualties for this sort of weather event.
Yeah, dude, it snapped a full grown, extremely healthy pine tree in my yard, and it was very close to doing a tremendous amount of damage, but geometry helped me out a little bit. But
all right, so let's wrap this thing up.
Yeah, we're going to wrap it up. Next episode, I'm going to talk in a little more detail. You know, I already talked about HIIT has a broad definition. It should be very accessible to a lot of different people. It's even used in cardiac rehab settings and different clinical populations in the literature. But again, to know that, you have to interact with the literature. So make sure your evidence-based fitness professionals every now and then check in on what we might consider evidence. That sounds like a really stringent set of characteristics that I'm demanding, but that's kind of part of the definition.
I think that's a bar most people should be able to clear.
Yeah. All right. To play us out, what do you got, Greg?
How about you do yours? Because I'll have more real world experience with mine next time we record.
Okay. So you're going to push it to next episode. Yeah. Okay. So, we often do these media recommendations to play us out. And I've kind of assumed that I just exist completely separated from media and entertainment, but I did more thinking about it, and that's not true. So I don't watch a lot of television or movies. I really don't watch much at all, to be frank, but I do interact with a lot of music, and I listen to podcasts every now and then. So I have decided I'm also going to give media recommendations. They just won't be television or movies. So I like music because I can listen to it while I'm doing things. Music while driving, music while working out, music while doing work sometimes. So I want to start giving some music and podcast recommendations. And my first one, of course, has to be Radiohead. It's my favorite band ever by a wide margin. Also Jeff Nippard's favorite band, to the best of my knowledge.
Interesting.
So interesting correlation there. He's pretty strong. So, you know, muscular people, perhaps if you listen to the music they like, I'm speaking about Jeff here, not me, but Jeff is a freak and he likes Radiohead. So that's good. So Radiohead, if you're not familiar, they've been doing an album every 2 to 5 years since 1993. So they have 9 studio albums, dating all the way back to 93. When I hear like a TV recommendation and someone says, great news, there's 15 seasons that are all 20 episodes long, I say, absolutely not. I don't want anything to do with that, because with a show, you want to work your way through its entirety. It's almost more feasible to deal with a show that has a less complete archive of episodes. But with music, you want it to be a huge kind of deep pool of music so that you can continue to explore different sounds and different albums and things like that. So I have a completely inverse relationship with music, where I love hearing about a new band and I say, oh my God, they've got, you know, 6, 7, 8 albums. Like, that's great. So I don't have a favorite Radiohead album, but you can organize them into tiers based on how accessible they are, because some of Radiohead's albums are extremely experimental. And if you dive right into those, it might be a bit difficult to pick them up. But easy access, if you're like, hey, I'd like to check out this band and see what they're all about, The Bends and Hail to the Thief are very accessible to a general listening audience. The next step up, you'll see albums like OK Computer, In Rainbows, The King of Limbs, A Moon-Shaped Pool. Those are more in like the moderate range. If you want to do a deep dive, you can listen to Kid A and Amnesiac. Those are their most experimental albums. And then finally, you can listen to Pablo Honey. That's their first album. And if you listen to all the others and then that, you'd say, absolutely not. This cannot be the same band. I refuse to believe it. So I wouldn't start with Pablo Honey, because it's my least favorite album of theirs by far. It's their least favorite album of theirs. They kind of refuse to play it when they play shows. And no one's really asking for it anyway. But yeah, so Pablo Honey, I would say to the end, just almost as like a museum exhibit of like, holy crap, how did we get from there to all the rest of their albums? But each album is its own thing. And they even have a lot of side projects you can get into. Their lead singer, Tom York, has had a ton of side projects. Almost every band member has done some pretty high profile solo work. And then Johnny Greenwood, the guitarist, has done some really popular film scores. So he did There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread, You Were Never Really Here, Spencer, The Power of the Dog, and many more. And those were like pretty big movies that... So you've probably heard music from members of Radiohead simply through viewing the films that I've never seen. And the nice thing about Radiohead, I've already mentioned this huge... You could go through their studio albums, their film scores, their solo projects, their side projects... But some of my favorite Radiohead songs are actually B-sides or unreleased tracks that never made it onto an album. So like, I've been digging into their entire library of music for 15 years, mm-hmm. and I still find new songs and I say, I think this might be one of my favorites, you know? So nice. If you're looking for a band that has like a huge archive of, you know, a huge library of songs that you can really dig into with a lot of different sounds from album to album, I couldn't recommend Radiohead highly enough. And I'll be giving some more recommendations in the future.
Sounds good.
All right. So we better shut this thing down before we lose power. But this is a normal length of an episode anyway, so we did well. As always, thank you very much for listening. And we will be back in 1 week, I hope, with another episode.
Thank you for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, be sure to sign up for our free newsletter to get concise breakdowns of relevant research, as well as 28 free training programs for all skill levels and all schedules. We hate spam just as much as you do, so we'll only email you when we have something really interesting to share with you. You can sign up for the free newsletter at strongerbyscience.com/newsletter, or just go to the Stronger by Science homepage and click the free programs button at the top. If you want to join in on the Stronger by Science podcast conversation, be sure to check out our Facebook group and our subreddit. The links for both are provided in the description of today's episode. Finally, please remember that we are not medical doctors or registered dietitians. So, before you make any changes to your exercise or nutrition habits, be sure to check with a qualified healthcare professional. Once again, thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of the Stronger by Science podcast.
Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 4/22 through 4/28. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.